That's not a problem.
I'll introduce you. I'll go get a cookie, and I'll be back.
That'll be great.
Okay. All right. Sten Vermont is my name, Institute for Global Health. We have a little bit of competition. Our original plan was 4 o'clock, and most of you know that the State of the Medical Center by Harry Jacobson once a year, scheduled after we had Professor Zimmerman's schedule set, so we switched the time, but a lot of people are going 4 o'clock to that and not coming here. So it would have been nicer if this were a little seminar format, a little more intimate, so we'll just pretend. I'm glad most of you are clustered around here, and Ken will hold the fort in the back. So Rick Zimmerman, known as Eli's dad, who's the president of the second-year class in the medical school center, is a long-standing professor of communications at the University of Kentucky. But about 3-4 years ago, he went over to the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation, whose roots are in Berkeley, California, hence its name, but has its corporate headquarters in the D.C. area. And I think there's 7 venues around the United States where this research and evaluation group works, very heavily focused on behavioral science, NIAAA, NIMH, NIDA-funded operation. And I actually met Rick on a study section and then learned about his son here and then have worked with Stephen Kennedy, who is at Pierre in Louisville, where Rick is, and Stephen is the gentleman who came to visit us on Liberia issues with RAND, Nisbet. So all sorts of potential connections. And we've had a delightful lunch just now talking about potential partnerships between Vanderbilt and Pierre on topics of very strong mutual interest. And I think you're going to see the topics of strong mutual interest for the next 45 minutes. So without further ado, Rick, whose background, by the way, is a medical sociologist, although when you read the papers he's written, he's got a very protean background, which I think medical sociologists tend to do. And so without further ado, welcome to Vanderbilt.
Thank you. Thanks very much. What I'm going to do today is a couple of things. First thing I'm going to do in this talk, what works in HIV prevention, is summarize a recent review of HIV prevention interventions, actually that a colleague of mine completed, Seth Knorr, and that's the handout that you have. This was published in AIDS and Behavior. Actually, it's not out yet. These days you can get things online before they're actually published. So this is a review that's coming out soon. And the second part, I'm going to show some examples of HIV preventive intervention materials, if you will, that we've developed and that we've used. So let me get started here. Where are things in HIV prevention? 25 years into the epidemic, there are many interventions that have been found to be effective. However, and the second bullet is really one of the most troubling ones to the public health community in the United States. The incidence of HIV/AIDS decreased dramatically upon the introduction of antiretrovirals, but pretty much has been stable, flat, right around 40,000 new cases a year in the U.S. for about the last 6-7 years. And one would hope that if prevention were really doing what one would hope it would do, that number would decrease. And so there's been lots of hand-wringing over the last several years about what's not going right about prevention here in the United States. And for example, incidence rates are 8 times higher for African-American men than Caucasian men, and over 20 times higher for African-American women than Caucasian women. And the next piece, programs that work under controlled research conditions may not be implemented with fidelity in community settings. So while there may be a bunch of programs that quote-unquote work or worked when they were carefully evaluated in controlled research settings, when they tried to roll them out into the community, thank you, into the community, they may or may not have been implemented with fidelity and may or may not still work, given that they're implemented by different sorts of folks with different populations. Okay? It's also quite possible that there's simply not enough prevention going on. That the, whoops. Okay. Sorry. Well, it will be, and we will get to it. But I just knocked the drive in by mistake, standing over there. I'll move. Sorry. But so another piece may be that there's simply not enough prevention that's being implemented in terms of the numbers of folks who are at risk. I mean, some other scary statistics in gay men: the last 2 or 3 years, STD rates have begun to increase significantly again. After they had been down for about 10 years. Unfortunately, one of the things that is difficult about epidemics of transmissible diseases that go on for a period of time, this is unusual, right? Those epidemics are usually short-lived. You know, there's some flu thing, it lasts a year or two, and then folks are on to different epidemics. Well, this is a long-term epidemic of a transmissible disease. It changes. The epidemic changes. I mean, for heaven's sakes, the virus probably changes. But so, for example, big campaigns and awareness focus in the 1980s in the U.S. made a real difference in the early 90s in terms of behavior. And so then there's a sense that we've taken care of that problem, and then folks move on to something else. Well, now there are new 16 and 17 and 18-year-olds who are moving into the age of sexual activity in this country, and that problem is no longer taken care of. It's now a new group of folks. So it's an ever-changing set of issues and problems for prevention as the epidemic goes on. So let me review this meta-analysis, just to give you a sense of what we know about HIV prevention that works. This, it's very unusual to have the opportunity to actually look at, I think the number here is 18 published meta-analyses in one field. A lot of resources have gone in to synthesizing this literature. Largely CDC has funded a significant amount of that to try to stay on top of, are interventions working? What do we know about interventions that are working? To try to synthesize the literature. That often does not happen in an area. And so my colleague Seth Knorr did a meta-analysis, which is really secondary analysis of results of studies that have already been done, of meta-analyses. And these meta-analyses, as you see on table one, were reviews of HIV preventive intervention with adolescents, heterosexuals, Hispanics, men who have sex with men, drug users, people with severe mental illness, STD clinic patients, and people living with HIV. Okay? So there were meta-analyses within all of those subpopulation groups. And in terms of the methods, there are lots of effect size coefficients that one can look at in meta-analyses. They turned all of these into odds ratios to look at, in terms of the outcome measure, like regular condom use or unprotected sex, the odds of typically improving on the outcome measure in the experimental group compared to a comparison or control group. And as you see in table two, all 11 meta-analyses that analyze the effects of interventions on condom use found significant results, with a median odds ratio of 1.34, again meaning that the experimental groups were about 34%. The odds of people in the experimental groups using condoms regularly were about 34% higher than those in the control or comparison groups. Most of the meta-analyses that had looked at unprotected sex also found significant results. Two-thirds of those that looked at STD acquisition found significant results, though most of the studies that looked at number of partners and trying to reduce the number of partners were not significant. By population, those with men who have sex with men, people living with HIV, and Hispanics and Latinos had the strongest effects, more moderate for heterosexual adults and drug users, and the most mixed effects were found in adolescents and STD clients. Now, really, in many ways, it's the next slide that's most important. Okay, many of these interventions were significant. What distinguished the interventions that were successful from those that were not? What are the components of interventions that were more likely to be successful? This is a brief summary of those results. For one thing, those interventions that were delivered to a single race or gender group and targeted that single group tended to be more effective than those that involved both males and females or multiple racial and ethnic groups. When there was a matching between the facilitators and participants in race, those interventions were more likely to succeed. Those interventions that included skills training in skills, typically negotiation kinds of skills that involved role-playing for folks to practice the lines that they would then need to use when they were in the real-life situation, those interventions were more likely to succeed. And those interventions based on theory tended to be more efficacious than those not theory-based. And I'm just presenting here a couple examples for those not familiar with this field of what some of the theories tend to look like. This is an integrated model of behavior change based, for those who are familiar with it, largely on the theory of planned behavior that suggests, and indeed largely show, that the three primary causal elements leading to behavior change are attitudes about the behavior, norms, typically it's measured in a variety of ways, either what your peers are doing or what people who are important to you think you should do, and self-efficacy or confidence and ability to do the behavior, lead to intentions which lead to behavior. And a more complex model that we've been testing that starts with the same elements, attitudes, norms, self-efficacy, intention, behavior, but tries to bring in more contextual components, including situational variables at the top right, preparatory behaviors at the bottom right, social environment, individual differences, and social structural variables at the far left. I teach a whole course in this. I'm not going to take any more time on the theories. I just wanted to give you a couple of examples of theories. Any questions so far? Please, if you have questions, ask. Yes. Okay. The reason, and I must say, it's my understanding. You know, this is not exactly my expertise, but I have a basic understanding. My understanding is that, by and large, the introduction of antiretrovirals reduced new transmission of HIV because. And this is the part that my understanding is it's not exactly clear connection is. Because people who are taking ARVs and successfully and dramatically reduce their viral loads are less likely to lead to a person that they're having sex with contracting the virus. Go ahead. And
it isn't consistent, though. There are examples in published literature where people on, say, protease inhibitors are more likely to have high-risk behavior.
Yeah.
Because they think that, disinhibition, yeah, they think that they're okay. But on balance, the literature suggests if you're in a care environment, knowledge of status, you're going to practice low-risk behavior than if you're seropositive, not in a care environment.
The primary reason why that's so connected to ARVs is because the interest and, in fact, the likelihood of being tested and being aware of HIV status dramatically increased when ARVs started to become available, because you could do something about it. Up until then, you really couldn't. Yeah, and again, it is not a perfect relationship, and my understanding is the virology people still don't know exactly how much reduction in transmissibility there is at various times, but clearly there's a dramatic reduction. So what I'd like to do now, having sort of reviewed the literature on what works and what seem to be important components, is to talk a little bit about three interventions that we have conducted. The first one, and give you some examples from each, an alcohol and HIV prevention curriculum in South Africa. The second one, mass media public service announcement campaign to increase condom use. That was in the U.S. And a choose-your-own-adventure simulated date as part of an interactive computer-based intervention that was also in the U.S. Let me tell you a little bit something about this project in South Africa. It's called HAPS, HIV and Alcohol Prevention in Schools, funded by NIAAA, the National Institute on Alcoholism and Alcohol Abuse of NIH. Focuses on delaying early sexual debut and reducing the onset and use of alcohol. The curriculum is essentially an integration and adaptation from Project Northland, Amazing Alternatives curriculum, Cheryl Perry, University of Minnesota, and Reducing the Risk curriculum, which has been found to be effective in reducing HIV-related risk behavior, both in the U.S. We spent about a year and a half and we were in Pietermaritzburg, South Africa, in KwaZulu-Natal, which is probably the region in South Africa with the highest HIV prevalence, somewhere around 20, maybe 25% of the entire adult population. That's real high prevalence part of the world. We spent about a year and a half working with teachers, students, administrators to get reactions to these two curricula, and made a lot of adaptations based on comments and discussions we had with folks there. One of the initial reasons, by the way, that we combined alcohol and HIV, everybody in KwaZulu-Natal, and again, remember, this is one of the regions of the world with the highest HIV prevalence, said, "We're tired of hearing about HIV. We're just sick and tired of hearing about it. You know, they talk about it all the time." And again, it was disappointing to hear that because, my God, so many folks are dying, but folks were tired of hearing about it. But alcohol was fairly new in the indigenous black community in South Africa because they had not had access. They had not had very easy access to alcohol during the apartheid era. Well, they got it. I mean, you know, folks can get anything anywhere if they want to. But access to alcohol was not anywhere near as free and open during apartheid as it had become in the subsequent 10 years or so. And so there was great interest in trying to do something about this emerging problem. It was newer there than it is here, this emerging problem of alcohol abuse among adolescents. So they thought, come in and do an alcohol curriculum and you know, sort of combine the HIV piece with that, and everybody may feel more excited about it. I think that turned out to be the case. It was a participatory program delivered with assistance by student-identified peers. In the key materials, creation of four characters who represent negative, positive, or transitional characters. Transitional meaning moving from more problematic behavior to safer decision-making, who are confronted with choices around risky behavior. It's a 14-session curriculum. And I should say, and this comes from Amazing Alternatives, a primary interactive part of the curriculum that students absolutely loved are monologues by the characters. In South Africa, in KwaZulu-Natal, in township schools, which are still very poor and under-resourced, I think this would not be the case in the U.S., a classroom of 40 to 50 students would sit absolutely spellbound listening to a CD of somebody talking, a character that they're getting to know, somebody their age. And we worked with a production company and script writers in KwaZulu-Natal to put to develop characters that worked there. And so I know this writing is small, but this combines Zulu and English, which is the way that kids and the teachers talk in KwaZulu-Natal. So this is Madumi, negative character. And my Zulu is not good enough to pronounce this all correctly, so I'm not going to read it. What can I say? I wish it were, but it's not. But so the characters go back and forth between Zulu and English. Again, we had a lot of interaction with adolescents. But you know, this gentleman says he's talking about girls that enjoy life and take alcohol. They won't trouble you with talk about condoms. I mean, you know, we should enjoy life. What's life without sex? And so on. So this is a negative character. Lulu is a transitional character. She's in grade 9. They should be turning 15. Parents treat her a little differently now. She's feeling good about that. But she said, you know, some of the things she hears are a little scary. She says that she doesn't need anybody to babysit her. So this is the introduction of this character, talking about her new independence that she's really enjoying. And again, as time goes on, there are, in the 14 lessons, in every lesson, there's at least one or two characters who talks about what's happening to them now. And then the students process what they've heard about the characters, what they think, and then they have interactive kinds of activities, including a lot of role plays about refusal, about delay, and ultimately about negotiating condoms for the kids who decide to have sex. There were 8 high schools located in townships, randomly assigned to either an intervention or comparison condition. The intervention group received 14 sessions of skills-based curriculum, the comparison group 3 sessions of knowledge-based curriculum. Their students are a little bit older than ours for the same grades. So the average age was about 15 and a half for the equivalent of about 9th grade students. And these are the results. Over 3 to 6 months, increase in positive attitudes about waiting to have sex, sexual refusal self-efficacy, alcohol refusal self-efficacy, intentions to have sex increase less, intention to use alcohol with sex increase less in the intervention group, and there was less initiation of sexual activity in the intervention group. Over 12 to 15 months, greater increases in sexual refusal self-efficacy, less increase in intentions to have sex, and less initiation of sexual activity. About 20% lower initiation of sexual activity in the intervention group as compared to the comparison group. Yes?
What happened to the alcohol refusal variable in 12 to 15 months? You implied it was no longer statistically significant. Was that due to actually initiating alcohol, or was it due to fall off and follow up or sample size issues? Or
yeah, good question. We still haven't completely figured it out. But you certainly did pick up on one of the disappointments to us, which is that the effects were more significant and longer lasting on the sexual behavior side than they were on the alcohol side. This was already a second iteration of this curriculum. We had done some pilot testing where we found practically no effects on alcohol, even in the short term. We added more alcohol-related skills building, which led to the 3 to 6 month effects. My inclination is there probably still needs to be more. Proportionally, I think we're still probably about 70-30 sex to alcohol, and it was probably about 85-15 to start with. I think it may need to be closer to 50-50 in the content. Go ahead. It's a good question, and certainly one that a reviewer these days of an NIH grant will ask about. Here's what I think. I think that in a school setting where you're building this into a life orientation skills class which already exists, then I think the number of hours is unlikely. Because it's not like a community program where they're getting more attention from somebody for 14 hours versus 3 hours of attention. The number of classroom hours with the teacher and with the class is identical. Just the content of the material that they're getting during the various classes will differ a bit. So I think given that it was built into an ongoing regular class. The other kids got 11 hours of something else going on in their classroom. So I think in this particular case, though I know there are folks who don't necessarily buy the argument, I think that we can be relatively confident that it was the material and the skills building that happened in the one curriculum than the other. In our next proposal, we're going to equalize the 2 hours, the two sets of hours, just to make those persnickety reviewers who still think the number of hours need to be the same, even though everybody's spending the same number of hours in class a day anyway, just to make them happy, I think we're going to up the number of hours to be equal. Mm-hmm. We actually spent a lot of time, energy, and resources in trying to get the best data we could and to reduce social desirability. And in fact, over the course of the study, you hate to change methods during the course of a study. Over the course of the study, we moved from paper and pencil surveys where it was clear in a very crowded classroom that there were some serious issues around people looking at each other's papers and privacy concerns, to personal digital assistance, the use of PDAs for data collection, with headphones and sound, where it was clear there was and the data support this, there was much greater sense of privacy and ability to be honest and confidentiality. So it wasn't as good as it might have been at the beginning of the study, but I'm confident it was very strong by the end of the study. And again, it's a randomized design, so confident that as far as the long term follow up results that we were getting, probably the best data you could get. It's a good question. You know, sexual behavior, unlike drug use, is a tough behavior to get biological markers of, particularly in an adolescent population. As we move forward, we are starting to do more biological testing, and I think we probably will in this sample. Trying to think of his name. There's a test for Y chromosome. Do you guys use that at all? Are you familiar with it at all? There's a test for Y chromosome in the genital area of females, which seems quite good over a short period of time at assessing whether there was unprotected sex. That would be something we might consider doing. Okay, but in this study, we did not. Other questions? Yes, sure. You guys are asking all the right questions, but so I have to tell all the truth about this study. We did. Fairly similar to lots of school-based studies, the effects were greater for girls than for boys. Boys are tough. in fact, they're still tough when they're young adults, with all due respect. But the effects were in the right direction for both genders, but only statistically significant when analyzed separately for girls. There was a nothing. There was not a part of the intervention that happened outside the classroom. No, that's not true. There was a creative portion of the intervention, where a couple of months after the main intervention in the classroom. We worked with teachers and facilitators to help the students put together about a half-day presentation where we actually provided an initial script of a play that they could modify. And we worked with them to do that. They could also write poems, essays, put up flyers and song and dance. So we did actually work with that as a booster, if you will, to hopefully, we had hoped, sustain the effects of the program. With regard to peers, other than that, we train peers mostly to work with teachers in the classroom setting. I think it was probably helpful because the classes average about 50 students. In a very cramped space. So to have peers work with smaller groups of students to help lead the conversations about role plays, I think probably gave at least a slightly more intensive skills building experience. But we didn't compare that to another condition. So I can't tell you based on experimental evidence whether it was helpful or not. Other questions? Further investigation, you see at the end there, is to required to understand why the alcohol component did not last longer. You know, I think the main, this was a, I'll be honest, this is a very exciting and emotional moment for me to see that we could put together a curriculum that significantly delayed initiation of sexual activity in a part of the world where the prevalence rate is 20 to 25% with HIV. Mm-hmm. I like that idea. Okay.
Of course, in NIH, you're doing that.
Right. That's probably right.
Behavioral herd immunity has been described.
Was there another hand? No? Okay. Let me tell you a little something. I'll move a little faster here. About a two-city public service announcement campaign to increase condom use. The two cities were Lexington, Kentucky, and Knoxville, Tennessee. They involved intensive three-month campaigns in each city. This is the design. This is a repeated cross-sectional time series design. Indeed, an interrupted time series design where you're collecting data for a period of time before the intervention started, during, and after the intervention to see whether the trends change over time. We collected data from 100 young adults in each city every month, sampled from college students and some random digit dial respondents. We collected data 9 months before the first campaign in Lexington, 9 months between the two campaigns, 3 months during the campaign, and then 9 months after the second campaign. I'm going to present results of the first campaign. We spent about a year and a half conducting focus groups and reaction groups, getting reactions to public service announcements already available, see what folks liked. We focused on high sensation seekers and impulsive decision makers, two high-risk groups, so we wanted to know what they liked, what they thought. They're hard to persuade groups as well. They helped us come up with the most promising PSAs. We wrote then 25 scripts, got the number down to the 10 favorites, and favorites, the most important variable to assess public service announcements is, do you think this will work? Do you think this will be effective for people like you? Not, do you like it? And ultimately produced 5 PSAs. Also got some really excellent PSAs from the Kaiser Family Foundation that had run some with MTV. These were the categories: threat, personal risk, benefits, negative consequences, and skills. And here are 2 of the PSAs that were part of the campaign. Nope, not yet. Okay. About 80%, this is a $120,000 campaign over 3 months. About 80% of folks saw at least 3 or more PSAs. The average number was approximately 22 PSAs. Nice thing you can do these days is right on the laptop when people are filling out the survey, you can show the actual PSA, the video, and ask people if they saw it. Whoops, I just, darn it.
Okay, sorry.
Okay, but we are going to see a PSA. Here we go. The results. You see in Lexington where the campaign was going on, the street yellow line, condom use was declining as it does. This was a cohort. We were aging a month every month. So they were getting slightly older as time went on. Condom use was going down because they're more likely to be in a relationship as they age from 18 to 24. During the campaign and for 4 months after, condom use went up significantly and then returned to its earlier trend. Similar but opposite results for unprotected sex. Number of occasions of unprotected sex have been going up before the campaign, went down significantly during the campaign, and then returned to a previous trend line. We've estimated that about 160,000 episodes of unprotected sex were avoided as because of the large population, about one per month, about one fewer unprotected sex episode per month for about 4 months, with a target population of about 40,000 people as a result of the campaign.
I used to party all the time. I hooked up with a few guys along the way, but I always had safe sex, except when I got into a relationship. I never thought I would get an STD from my own boyfriend. I didn't know he had it. When I found out I had herpes, I felt so dirty, and I'll have it for life. He told me he loved me, and he'd give me anything. Well, he gave me something he can't ever take back.
Just want to give you, finally, with this CD that I keep knocking into the computer, the campaign we're running now in two southern cities, similar design, to see if we can delay initiation of sexual activity in 10 to 14-year-olds. And I want to show you a couple of those PSAs. Okay.
Bring it up now.
I can give you everything you dream about.
I can give you something you won't forget.
I can be someone you really need.
Find out. Maybe we should wait.
You know what? Let's just go back to the party.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, and one more example. I think a medium that is increasingly becoming really important for us to understand more about and learn to use. It turns out, at age 51, I'm so old. At age 30, I was really old for middle school students. And just what's possible with technology and how young people are using technology, we need to increasingly tap into it and use it. They get excited about it. They pay attention to it. Here's an early example. There's a lot more that we can do now than we could 5 years ago when we first designed this. This was part of a booster campaign with interactive activities.
Welcome to A Date with Destiny. In this activity, you will be making decisions about alcohol, dating, and sex. Please click continue to begin. Are you male or female?
Should we be male?
Okay. Who would you like to go on a date with?
I won't ask. Let's go out with Kendra, shall we? Oh, I'm sorry.
You have chosen to go out with Kendra. The two of you decide to start the date by going to dinner. Kendra suggests two restaurants. Do you decide to have dinner at the cheaper place or a more expensive place?
That decision's not important, but it gets them into the story. All right?
You have dinner at the cheaper restaurant. You both enjoyed your meals and had a nice time just talking to one another. When the bill comes, it is $12. Do you offer to pay the entire meal? After dinner, you aren't ready to go home. You both decide you would like to stay out longer. Do you decide to go to a movie or to a party that you both know about?
Let's go to the party because the outcomes are more exciting.
You decide to go to a party. Lots of people you know are there, and they all seem to be having a really good time hanging out and dancing. You didn't realize it before, but there are no adults there, and some people brought alcohol to the party. After you've been there a while, someone offers some beer to you and your date. You're not sure if you want to, but you don't want people to think you're...
I'm going to speed this
up a little bit. You decide to have something to drink, but your date doesn't because she remembers she has to drive later. You've never really had much to drink before, and you can really feel it affecting you. You keep drinking, and you're soon drunk. You still have enough sense to know that your ability to make good decisions is seriously impaired. Your date sees that you're pretty bad off and suggests that you might need to go out and get some air. Do you leave with your date, or do you stay with your friends? You stay with your friends. Because you stayed with a group of people, rather than going off alone with your date, the worst thing that happened to you that night was that you got sick and embarrassed yourself. This ends the activity.
And there are about 50 different decision trees in this. If you had stayed with the date, you had the option of going off into a room with them. And if you did that, you had the option of he set a pressure line, and you had to think about what you were going to say back to him. You had some time to think about that, process that, and then multiple choice questions to decide what you're going to say back. If you said okay, then you started having sex, and maybe he then said that he didn't have any condoms. Did you want to go ahead or not? And then ultimately, the outcomes that are possible include you got pregnant, you got one of several STDs, including HIV. Most of the STDs show you a picture of what your genitalia might look like if you got that STD. You might have, if you then had to go back for treatment, etc. So it brings you through an entire series of possible choices and outcomes. We got some very nice short-term results. And indeed, in a pilot test, this plus four other components delayed initiation of sexual activity. These were Appalachian kids in Kentucky. These were the six components of the intervention. But it's clear they liked to choose your own adventure the most. I'm at the end of my time, so I'm going to move quickly here. I would say the results, to sum up the results, it looks like a promising intervention that needs some work. I wanted to mention, since the primary folks who are bringing us here is the Institute for Global Health, a little bit about the international work we're doing. Family-based intervention in Bangkok, Thailand, work with anti-AIDS clubs in Ethiopia, adaptation of intimate partner violence intervention for secondary school students in Cape Town, South Africa, continuing to expand on the alcohol and HIV school-based prevention in South Africa, and development of a campaign to delay sexual activity in India. Where do we need to go from here? More research on diffusion, translation of effective programs into the community, refocusing on high-risk populations that there was a sense 10 years ago we've taken care of them, but now their risk behaviors are increasing again. Increased focus on getting people tested to know their HIV status for some of the reasons mentioned earlier, and an increased focus on prevention programs with persons living with HIV. It's the end of my time. I don't know how fast you're going to run out of here, but I'd be happy to take questions either publicly or up here. Thanks.
approximately $500,000 a year budget that you have at NIH. So metro areas of about 400,000 and smaller is all we can afford, basically.
So you conduct the repeat assessment over your study period. Is it, the subject is the same or different?
Different. They're different. We essentially, we randomly sample from the same population 100 every month. So they are different respondents. So it's a repeated cross-sectional data collection.
Well, thank you for listening.
We appreciate it.
Okay. I'll stick around for a couple of minutes in case anybody wants to ask any more.